Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. This week on CounselorAudioSource.net, Dr. Jeffrey Smith, Associate Professor and Director of the Counselor Education Program at Creighton University, speaks with contributing editor Dr. Teresa O'Halloran about counseling men.
So, welcome to another edition of CounselorAudioSource.net. This is Dr. Teresa O'Halloran, and today I have Dr. Jeffrey Smith from Creighton University to speak to us about counseling men and some of the essential considerations involved in counseling men. So, Dr. Smith, glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. So, first start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and what gets raised your interest in working with men.
Sure. Well, first of all, this is my sixth year here at Creighton, and it's been an exciting 6 years as we've been attempting to get our counseling program to a place where students are excited about being here and our faculty are excited and where word gets out that we're doing good work. So I'm really happy to be here and pretty excited about that. Prior to Creighton, I actually did all of my work, undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate work at Kent State University under Don Mubenzer and John West there. And so after starting there, I had an opportunity to work with an instructor or professor, actually in the psychology program, and she was doing work on fear, and it was some was on test anxiety and fear, test anxiety, and young students' social evaluation apprehension. And so as a result of that, I began to think about some things that were of interest to me, and one of them was fear, men's fear, just sort of globally men's fears.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really intrigued by that, and we used an instrument, the Fear Survey Schedule. We used the revised edition for children. But I began investigating the Fear Survey Schedule that had been normed on college students and adults, and wanting to pursue this whole phenomenon of men in fear. And ultimately, when I began work on the dissertation, Dr. West and Bubenzer thought that I probably should be pursuing something related to men and their fear of counseling services. And so ultimately what we did was we wind up condensing it and refining the topic. And so we began I began to pursue that and ultimately pursue the dissertation to see if we could determine or ascertain if some men were fearful, if fear was actually the component or the emotion that prohibited them from using mental health counseling services. And so that's been my pursuit since then. The dissertation, I looked at African-American men, but now I'm looking at men sort of in general. I'm looking not only if fear is what is a barrier, but what are the other barriers that prevent men from using mental health counseling services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, it's a big topic. Interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to our discussion here.
Yeah, it'll be good.
Looking forward to it. Yeah. So this is kind of maybe a silly question, but why is it important for us to focus on what the special issues in counseling men?
Sure. I don't know if this will be widely accepted, but this is a belief that I have. Number one, I think unfortunately we have seen historically and even in contemporary times, we see men being self-injurious and other injurious. Men hurt themselves. They hurt other men. Men hurt themselves. They hurt women. Men hurt themselves. They hurt children. Men hurt themselves. They hurt the environment. I mean, and not just limited to those things. And so I've always thought that at some level, men should be talking about what's going on with them so that they aren't so self-injurious and so that they aren't so other injurious, whether it's mm-hmm. other human, whether it's other humans or whether it's the environment or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly believe that that counseling can actually give men a forum with which to talk about what's going on with them so that they can be less self-injurious and less other injurious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So, boy, that does sound important. And I wonder, what are some of the challenges in providing services to men then to help them address their fears and...
Sure, sure. I think number one, the research is clear, and I don't know that we have enough empirical data on this, but I think everyone sort of experientially, from a counseling standpoint, even from a research standpoint, I think we all experientially recognize that men are not going to be the ones that are going to volitionally come to us as counselors. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Courtland Lee and I think it's Lee and Bailey actually wrote about the fact that in most instances, men are, there's some third party entity that's usually stronger than the man himself is that mandates that he should come to counseling. And when that happens, then counseling seems to be punitive
mm-hmm.
and more reason for the man to reject it or to be resistant to it. And so I think that that's one of the challenges that men, for whatever reason, don't volitionally choose us. And also, I think that one of the other barriers and one of the other challenges is, again, and this is not to really sound pejorative of men, but I think men are ignorant of what actually goes on in a counseling session
mm-hmm.
or what counselors can ultimately do for them. And so the fact that they don't volitionally choose us might actually have something to do with their ignorance about what counselors do or what, or ignorance about the counseling profession. So I think those are the, in my mind, the major challenges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I wonder also if it's part ignorance of what happens in counseling and also maybe, myth about counseling is all touchy feely and so men want to stay away from that.
Sure, sure. I think in addition to possibly being touchy-feely, I think that in lots of instances, men may misattribute what counselors do as related to maybe what other mental health or other professionals do. So hypothetically, maybe a man thinks that when he comes to see a counselor at some point in time, he might be coerced to take some type of injection, some pharmaceutical injection, or maybe not injection, but maybe mm-hmm. to take some oral pharmaceutical to calm himself down. Or
mm-hmm.
maybe the man thinks that the things that he might share with the counselor are going to be given to someone else that's going to ultimately harm him, or maybe the man thinks that the counselor is going to do something like maybe a physician would do. I guess my point, the global
mm-hmm.
point is that I think men can also misattribute what goes on in a counseling session. And to some degree, I think that that might be their fault, but I also think that some of the onus, we need to bear some of the onus because at some level, I don't know that we explain to men. I don't know that we necessarily market ourselves as well as we possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And the most reluctant user of our services probably should be the person that has the most information.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Excellent point. Mm-hmm. So, getting that information out is a challenge.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that this is, I know this isn't a part of the questions that we're discussing right now. And I don't know where I've seen it presented or where it's been discussed, but I think at some level we probably should be more, I think we can exert more effort in allowing the public to know who we are and what it is that we do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And my sense is some of the more concrete, goal-driven activities that we're involved in may be more amenable to men versus this sense of we're going to work through your feelings and, you're going to have to cry and other myths that men may have.
Sure. I actually did some research with a group of adolescent guys, and one of the things that came through that was really interesting as a result of the work that we did some survey research with them, and just quickly, they talked, 88% of them had never used mental health counseling services or they weren't familiar with it. 69% of them expected to use counseling services in their future.
Oh, wow.
And
interesting.
That was really intriguing to me. And then in the end, what we asked them a question about, what would signal to you, what activities or what would the counselor be doing or what activities would you be engaging in that would signal to you that your counseling was successful? And overwhelmingly, these guys talked about an action-oriented counseling. The fact that the counselor, that they didn't necessarily want to just simply sit down with the counselor. They wanted to either work on a project or they wanted to be outside or they wanted to be doing some other activity in addition to that. And so I think at some level there might be some safety in not being forced to sit down and to simply emote,
mm-hmm.
to allow them to be able to do something else or to allow them to have some other type of action that's going on or that's accompanying the counseling,
mm-hmm.
that was new. I hadn't heard that. And I don't know that I haven't been able to get that. That's actually one of the things that the editor actually edited out of out of the manuscript. And so I have to reintroduce that because I think that's something new. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah, I think that's significant.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it relates to something I read by Wong and Rockland, that they discussed two ideas as the reasons why men tend to be less emotionally expressive, which is one of the reasons they may not attend counseling. And one of them they call normal male alexithymia, which is unawareness of emotional experiencing. I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is the influence of traditional gender roles that influence men's willingness or sense of appropriateness to express emotions. And what are your thoughts on those two ideas as a reason for men's tending to be less emotionally expressive?
Yeah. I'm not sure that I necessarily agree wholeheartedly. I know I agree with parts of the things that they presented, and there's some parts of it I think that I disagree with. The way that I think about it, I think that men have what I coin selective alexithymia. I think that at some level men choose to be less emotionally expressive based on a number of different issues. And they actually presented some of them in one of their articles. But I think a part of the reason why I disagree with some of it is because we know and we all see sort of demonstrated on a daily basis. We see men being publicly expressive in war. We see men being publicly expressive in sports and entertainment. I mean, guys win championships and they hug each other, they cry, and they're jumping up and down. They're mm-hmm. they look like little kids. Or we listen to men. We listen to the lyrics of songs and we hear men expressing. Kenny Rogers saying, you know, "Lucille, you picked a fine time to leave me. With, mm-hmm. you know, my heart's gonna break." Or "I wish it would rain so I could go outside because
right.
I'm crying." Or those kinds of things. And I think politics, we see men's emotional expressiveness in politics or in business and commerce. And I think that any time where we see the thrill of victory, this is kind of a sports cliche, but
mm-hmm.
anytime we see the thrill of victory and the agony or the agony of defeat and death, I think we see men in our country mm-hmm. being emotionally expressive.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they will be selectively inexpressive or that they have selected alexithymia when it comes to having to sit down and talk with some about their mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think that at some level, and we did some research with a group of physicians on this, but I think that at some level, some men, and according to these physicians, believe that men can be expressive about physical injuries. In other words, there's nothing wrong with a man who, because he was working on a lathe, he got his finger cut off or or and then gangrene set in, and then ultimately he has to get his hand cut off because it was infected. I mean, that's a physical injury or physical illness. I don't think that men look at that as being, I don't think that men look at that negatively. It may be a negative experience, mm-hmm. but I don't think that they look at themselves negatively if they have a bad heart, if they have to have an amputation. Something physically broke down. But I mm-hmm. think when there's a mental deficit, when there's this sense that something's mm-hmm. not right in their one's head, I mm-hmm. think that at some level that's an affront to the structure, to the social structure of who a man is. And so I think that men categorically would like to refuse anything that's related to or reject anything that's related to a mental deficit as opposed to a physical deficit. I think, again, that guys can accept the physical injury. They can accept mm-hmm. that much easier than they can accept mental deficits. And so I think, again, I like to think about it as selected athymia, alexithymia when I'm thinking about men. I think that I think that we see lots of instances where they're emotionally expressive, but I think I know, like most counselors do, that when they have to walk into the door, especially if there's a third party or there's another entity that's mandated counseling mm-hmm. for them, they're coming in resistant. I think that that they'll be mm-hmm. that we'll see them being less emotionally expressive.
That's interesting. It makes sense to me with some of the experiences I've had as a counselor working with men,
uh-huh.
that it seems always important, or maybe slightly more important for working with the men than the women, to be make sure that I'm lifting them up or supporting or citing the strengths that they have.
Sure.
To make the environment safe enough to help them be ready to discuss some of their things where they feel less confident. So it's like I have to, part of building the therapeutic relationship or the groundwork is making sure the environment's safe enough for them to allow themselves to be vulnerable and say, oh yes, well, actually at night, you know, I do have thoughts of suicide or giving up or, you know, overwhelm.
Sure.
But that takes, I think, a strong therapeutic ground where they feel safe enough.
Sure, sure. And I agree with you, just even as you identify your own experience, I think, and in relationship to the question that you asked previously, I think that there are times where female counselors really would be wise to employ certain strategies, but also I think to sort of present themselves almost as being androgynous, almost. I mean, sort of professionally androgynous. I think that your professional competence has got to come through, but I think either through the development of the therapeutic relationship, the questions that you ask, the therapeutic approach that you take, maybe the metaphors that you use, I think at some level mm-hmm. you have to sort of demonstrate this professional competence / androgyny, that you're not a female that's going to just sort of gush all over them with empathy. They may not necessarily need that. They may need to see this. They may need to see a strength from you in order to be able to, to demonstrate a strength or, you know, back mm-hmm. to you and what you just identified, your ability to be able to capture, to recognize, or to draw out, or to expose, or just to lift their assets, their strengths, and validate their strengths. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's one of those are the things I think that can demonstrate to them competence, but I think that they can also sort of demonstrate this professional androgyny that as a female, mm-hmm. you aren't going to seek to foundation yourself in the emotion only. That
right.
at some level you can work with them systemically on some things that are related to how they then have to go back and negotiate their world and the system as a result of, you know, them being mandated or, you know, whatever else is basically going on with them.
Yeah, yeah. And that goes back to your first point about, or your research on men's fears to me, because, you know, one big fear is for everyone who goes to counseling is this counselor is going to make me different, going to make me be somebody I'm not. And, that would bring up resistance right away.
Sure.
When a person believes that.
Sure. It's ironic that you mention that, because that's one of the things that we talk to our students about. And we say, when you're first explaining to your client, your male client, what the counseling process is, and again, Gladding talks about that in terms of talking about the counselor's responsibility is to structure the counseling setting, not just structure the actual environment, but structure what's going to ultimately happen in the counseling setting. And so we talk to our students about that very point, that at some level you have to explain to the client, especially the male client, this is what's going to ultimately happen. And as a result of that, I mean, our hope is always that the man will signal, I mean, that the man will find out and will understand at some level that he is going to have an opportunity to make some decisions in the session, in what actually goes on and what happens in the session. And that's really ultimately our responsibility in the structuring process. Let them know what's going to happen, solicit their support, and to let them know that at some level, I mean, we're not going to, or most of the time, we're not going to do anything that's totally contrary to what they want. I mean, we're working together to ultimately move them to where they want to go. I actually think I may not have responded to all of what you asked. So if you want to ask the question again, and I'll.
Oh, I think you did fine.
Okay.
I think you did fine. My mind leaped ahead, and
okay.
I'm thinking about, you started talking about Gladding's recommendations for opening a counseling session and to provide structure, and that helps the person feel safe. And I think that's wonderful. One of the thoughts that came to my mind when I thought about men in counseling is this whole idea. We know about Rogers' core conditions and the subsequent research, recent research, outcome research on what's effective in counseling continues to show that empathy is one of the key components to provide effectiveness in counseling. And so, you know, is that in conflict somehow with providing structure and providing empathy, or how do you see that working out?
Sure. I think they're actually consistent, and I think that they're complementary. Again, one of the things that we really talk to our students about is that, and as it relates to Rogers' core conditions, is we talk to our students about being professionally/culturally empathic. And that's a term that I think I was first introduced to I think it's Ridley. I think Ridley has written about that. But anyway, what that simply means is that at some level that the client is expecting us to have an understanding, have a professional cultural empathy that at some level understands their human dilemma. When we're able to understand the client's human dilemma and then able to demonstratively present it back to them as they presented it to us, we talk to our students about that might be the most important demonstrative act of competence that you can actually do. And so if at some level the client is, the male client presents his human dilemma and we ignore it or we don't recognize it and can't accurately present it back to him that we understood it the way that he sort of ideographically presented it to us, then I think that it can be discouraging for the male client thinking, again, well, here I am and this person just didn't get it for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always attempting to get our students to employ this professional cultural empathy by hunting for the human dilemma. So we tell them early on, I mean, we want you listening for everything, because at some particular point in time, you're going to analyze all that information and then synthesize it down and say, man, this is it. I think this is this person, this guy's human dilemma. Present it back to him and see if indeed we're accurate. And most of the time, when we can do that accurately, ascertain what the human dilemma is and then present it back to the client, to the male client, then as I said before, I think that that is the number one demonstrative act of competence mm-hmm. that we can present for our male clients. And then I think that that's even more important than us sort of, again, like Rogers's core conditions. I think that that's more important than just showing empathy. Mm-hmm. And I think competence, showing that we understand their dilemma is a demonstrative act of competence, which I think then shows that we have mm-hmm. some empathy because again, we've gotten it. We've gotten the essence of what they've wanted or what they've tried to present.
Right.
And then we've been able to accurately convey it back to them, which I think is vitally important. So I think that that's both an act of empathy, showing empathy, but I think it's a demonstrative act of competence that I think that sometimes might actually supersede empathy, because I don't mm-hmm. think that if there's any male client, any client that wants to believe that his or her counselor misses it. They give them the essence of their problem, and the client misses it.
Right, you know? Right. If the counselor says something like, so, after they explain it all, and the counselor says something like, so, how does that make you feel? Or, so, what brings you here? Yeah, you can just see their face fall, the client's face just fall and
yeah.
say, oh.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe you only have maybe two more times in a session to get it. I mean, it's not that the client may not come back, but I think that the client then might begin to recognize, you know what, you know, maybe this isn't the right place, or maybe this isn't mm-hmm. the right person.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that, and we try to explain to our students that you don't necessarily have to be afraid or be disappointed if you don't get it. Sometimes when you don't get it, the client will say, no, 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 not that, this. This is what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
And when they tell you that, then we say, then you
jump
have to
on.
Get it. Then, yeah, you can't miss it a second
yeah,
time.
Yeah, you know? Really. Yeah. Well, great. That connects to me as well for another idea about cultural considerations.
Sure.
And earlier I had a thought of a client that I worked with in my long past who worked in agriculture. And this is a male client. And I really did learn that I needed to learn about his world, use analogies related to farming and the environment. And I recognized it being a process for me when I got it, I could see in him, he was like, oh, thank gosh that you can talk to me about my tractor.
Sure.
Or, you know, the frustration of the water or so. What are your thoughts about cultural considerations and maybe racial considerations as well in this
sure,
question?
Sure, sure. I like that story, because that story really does emphasize exactly how I think as counselors we need to think about working with men differently. I think that we have to have a repertoire of metaphors and analogies that we can apply based on what the man has said. When we think about Ericksonian's utilization, I mean, we and some of the things that DeShazer's written, I mean, we aren't going to go too far. We should go too far away from the language and from the concepts or from the metaphors or the life presentations that the man presents. And so mm-hmm. the counselor who is skilled in the use of metaphors and analogies, and who can listen to the language and listen to the essence that the human dilemma, the essence that the man is presenting, and then present back to him analogies and metaphors that he can relate to. I mean, I think that those things are important. So yeah, I think that, you know, our understanding of the fact that springtime and harvest, that you're not going to get an immediate return, or mm-hmm. the fact of, you know, tools, or investment and then the ultimate yield. I mean, I think that what you were saying, our ability to be able to understand the metaphors and the analogies that men live in and that they experience, and then our ability to be able to use those, not changing the language, but using the language of the men, can be extremely helpful. With men of different cultures, as you identify, so whether we're talking about rural agrarian men or whether we're talking about men who are in other domains, whether they're business or sports or entertainment, you know, whatever that might be, our ability to do that is important. In addition to that, I think that when we're talking about racial, when we're talking about men, ethnicity and racially different men, and any of the other differences that that we can think of, I think one of the really important things that I always think about is that I want to sort of assure the men that that I'm not an agent of the state or of the system that's simply attempting to maintain the status quo on them. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I'm wanting the guys to know that if they have some argument with the system, whether it was, you know, judicial or, I mean, local or judicial, whatever the system is, that I'm not an agent of the system. I mean, I'm there to work with them based on what it is that's problematic for them, or based on what the goals or the objectives that they ultimately want to achieve. And so, so I think that's vitally important. I mean, and I think in the process, I think things like letting them know where the information that they're presenting, where it's ultimately going to go, or maybe where it's not going to go, letting them know that it goes as far as this file drawer, out of this file drawer, into my supervisor's office when I have to do supervision with him or her, mm-hmm. and back into the file drawer. Never ever will it leave this building and go to the courts for any mm-hmm. other reason. And considering that, or understanding that there might be times where we're obligated by law to report certain things, but after explaining those things to them, then we just kind of identify that the information or the data isn't going someplace mm-hmm. that could ultimately mm-hmm. hurt or harm them. I think also, again, as it relates to race and ethnicity, I think one of the other things that is important to think about too is, I think it's always important to understand and to recognize that there is a socio-political sort of side to that men experience. And so at some level, I think it's important to recognize what has the experience been for men of this racial or ethnic group? What has been their experience mm-hmm. in our country, either with our federal government or with the citizenry mm-hmm. in our country? Has the federal government, if they're Native American or American Indian men, I mean, I think that those men might not have the faith in our federal government as maybe some other groups are. Mm-hmm. Maybe African American men are suspicious. Maybe Japanese and Chinese men, you know, mm-hmm. Oriental men, maybe suspicious. Maybe Latino men are suspicious. I mean, with this whole question of immigration mm-hmm. being a hot topic for us right now, immigration has actually been a hot topic mm-hmm. over our country's history, but again, it's come to the forefront. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when we look at those things, or when we look at that and understand at some level, what's the socio-political conflict or the potential socio-political conflict for this man or men in his subgroup, in our country, I think that's vitally important to take into consideration, because this guy might have some suspicions about us. Mm-hmm. This guy might be reluctant to share with us because, again, he might at some level think that we're an agent of the system and we mm-hmm. ultimately can get him negatively involved in the system, and he may not want to do that. So those are just some of the things that I keep in the back of my mind mm-hmm. When I'm thinking about racial cultural issues and any of the other kinds of issues. And in closing on that particular point, I guess the next thing I really try to think about is, how is this man identifying himself? I mean, I need to listen for mm-hmm. what is he saying about himself. If I'm leaning to think of this guy as a Hispanic, and he says clearly, I am Jorge Guatemalan, then I can't think of him as a Cuban or a Colombian or a Panamanian. He's already identified himself as a Guatemala. And so I have to begin to think, okay, so what does that mean? If he's going to identify himself as Guatemalan, what does that mean? I have to assess for that or find out what that means. Or if he's a gay Guatemalan, I mean, what does that mean to him? So I think we have to listen for how the male client identifies himself and then begin to sort of ascertain, what does that mean to him? What don't I know about who he's saying he is?
Mm-hmm.
And as quickly as I can find that out, then I can begin to be consistent and congruent with who he is. I don't want to be incongruent with who he's identifying himself simply because I have a thought in my head about what it means to be who he is. I want to be congruent and find out what it means from him to be who he is and try to plan my work according to that.
And that's a challenging process, I think, especially for new counselors, to get a sense, to understand the client's world in that way, and to be able to see the client through their own eyes or glasses, as they might see it culturally and racially. What recommendations would you make for counselors? Like, how do you get that information from your client? Do you have some ideas of how?
Sure. One of the things that I do is that I will always look at the intake interview, because I think identifying information is always there on the intake interview. One of the things also that those that adhere to brief solution focus counseling talk about is again asking, soliciting collaboration from the client and finding out what is it that they ultimately want. Because again, I don't want to identify them outside of the way that they've identified themselves. I don't want to assume that I know what it is that they need before they've explained to me what it is that they've needed. And I, again, think going back to the concept of Ericksonian's utilization, I mean, I want to use the assets that they present. I want to use those things that are obvious and the things that they ultimately present. And so I think that those are the things I think that young counselors, should be considering. One of the simple things that I think sometimes doesn't happen is we just don't ask the question. We just don't ask. I mean, what is it that you want? I mean, we're going to be here for 50 minutes. How do you want your life, or how do you want your time to be better when we leave than it was when we came and then when you started? And so our ability to be able to ask the questions that will get what the client wants, I mean, are the kinds of questions that we should ask. And so again, for me, going to the intake interview to make sure that I have the information, the accurate information, at least as accurate as they presented it, because self-reporting. And so they could obviously present some information that might not be accurate, but going to the intake interview, asking what I think are those just sort of informational questions that help to get us on the right page, really mining out, looking for, hunting for, searching for those assets, and then being able to use those assets in our presentation, listening to their language and then speaking their language back to them in metaphors and in analogies. I mean, those are just some of the things that we attempt to do and encourage our students to do.
I see that you have studied a lot of marriage and family therapy.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes.
So it's fair to ask you this question then.
Sure.
Because the other thing that comes to my mind is, the maybe additional challenge or the importance of reaching the man in couples counseling or family counseling. And do you have some specific tips for that for folks?
Yes, I think I do anyway. Let's just begin saying, number one, I think that I think Nichols and Schwartz speaks to this probably as well as anyone else does. But I think initially when we start, one of the things that I think is really important to do is to find out, first of all, who's responsible for all of the people getting there. If it's a couple, obviously, who's responsible for the couple being here? And if it's a family, who's responsible for the family speaking there? I mean, for the family being here. And I think initially you have to speak to that person, because if they were successful in getting them there at that time, you want them to know that you respect and regard and what they've done and their ability to be able to get everyone there. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I think it's important to simply say that the data seems to support or suggest that the more involved the father is, or the more involved the man is in the process, the higher the results are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's one of those things that we should say, in order to begin to sort of plant the seed. I mean, we're in essence planting the seed that here is, we have an expectation of success, but here are the ingredients that need to be present in order for this dynamic to be successful. I think after that, I think it's important to at some level then begin to, and it may not be possible to do it all the time, but to show where there's agreement. I mean, the disagreement is going to come through all the time. And you don't have to work to, I mean, they'll manufacture that and they'll, you know, through enactment, they'll show you where the disagreement is. But what they might not see is they may not see where there is agreement. And I think about it from a structural standpoint that when I'm trying to join, I might actually put people together who are in agreement with a certain topic. And I might at some particular point simply take them or ask them if they'll kind of move around. I'll change the setting and the structure to show where now they're in disagreement with a person that they were in agreement with, and now put them beside the person that they're in disagreement, new agreement with. My point is that I think that that's one of those things that we can do from a family counseling standpoint. It's more related to structural mm-hmm. family counseling, and when we're trying to join, that we actually move people around and sort of show them that, you know, you're aligned with, and you're coalesced with this particular group on this particular topic,
mm-hmm.
and then when it changes, then kind of move them around and show them again. Mm-hmm. Now, well, even though you're with this subgroup on this particular topic, now here's where it sort of changes. I think that sometimes men may come into the counseling session and they may feel alienated because they've done something or because they haven't done something. And so I think that it's important to let them see, I mean, where they're aligned, but also, again, as I said before, the enactment will show them where there's discord and who mm-hmm. and where they're not aligned with. But I try not to allow the guy to be totally alienated in a session with his family, or again, if it's just a couple, try to identify in places where they're in agreement and where they're aligned and where they're a good group working together. And so that's just kind of mm-hmm. one of the ways.
Great.
Or a couple of the ways.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Helpful. So, we've covered a lot of ground here. I wonder, what, if there are other, considerations you'd want to make sure we talk about when working with men in counseling?
I think this all falls under the recommendations that I think that we mm-hmm. can discuss when we're talking about working with men. And for me, the number one consideration is always explain the process, because as we discussed earlier, not being negative or saying anything pejorative about men. I just think that there are times where men are ignorant about the process, or we know that men do indeed misattribute what goes on in a counseling session. So I think it's vitally important, according to Gladney, to just simply lay out the structure and explain the process. We work together for 50 minutes. Sometimes I ask questions. Lots of times, you know, you'll talk or whatever it is, or mm-hmm. or I'm going to actually solicit your support for this. I need to know, what is it that you ultimately want? I mean, how do you want this thing to be better?
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of those things. In addition to explaining all of the all of the instances of when we have duty and obligation to report. I mean, all of those things. Explain the entire process. There's nothing in my mind that's more important than the client having as much information as he can ultimately have.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, I believe that our ability to be able to keep ourselves out of court and out of litigation is based on our clients having the most information that they possibly could have.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that if something happens to them that's been external, outside of their control, that happened and they didn't sign off on it, I think that we could find ourselves involved in some litigation. And so we want to explain to our male clients the process as thoroughly as we possibly can, so that there's no surprise, so that at no time can he ever come back and say, well, you did this to me and you forced me to do this and I didn't want to do that and here it didn't work and so, and now I'm out of a job or now my mm-hmm. family's lost or now whatever it might be, mm-hmm. this bad thing happened to me and because you thought you knew what was best for me and now it didn't work. And so just explaining the process is the number one most important consideration. We even encourage our students after the third session to take your notes and actually show your client what it is that you've written about them. Not to give it to them, but just say, hey, this is what I've been writing. When you leave, this is what I write about you. So take a look at it and ask them if they agree that that's actually what they experienced in the session. If it is, then initial it. The initialing simply says that I read it, I understood it, I agreed to it, and here's my initial that says it. So that's all a part of the process, explaining the process so that this guy never, ever, ever can come back and say, this bad thing happened to me that I didn't sign off on, mm-hmm. and now you're going to pay for it. No, I want the client to be in the know throughout the entire process.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, after that, I think it's vitally important for the counselor to solicit collaboration to solicit and also to expect collaboration. I think that again goes back to the old Ericksonian utilization principles that at some level, I think that we want to demonstrate to the client that, as you identified earlier, that they have assets and that we're going to use their assets to ultimately help get to the objective or the ultimate goals that they are ultimately pursuing. And so to be able to explain to them that it's impossible for us to get to that point without their support and without their collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a way of saying that you have some assets, you have some skills, you have some abilities that are valuable, that we perceive as being valuable, and those are going to be instrumental in mm-hmm. how we're going to eventually work. I think that's number two, the second most important thing to do. Again, thinking again about the Ericksonian utilization principle. I think that it's vitally important, as you've identified, to be able to think and to be able to speak in metaphors and analogies with men. Because mm-hmm. men are going to speak to us in metaphors and analogies. They're going to say things like, you know, I feel as clumsy as a bull in a china shop. I mean, this guy is giving you lots of information
mm-hmm.
when he says something like that, or you know, I was so mad. I mean, I could just feel the steam coming out of my ears.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't have to guess. I mean, he is explicitly stating some things to us. And so I think when men speak in metaphors, again, I think, you know, Erickson would say, use what you're given. And so our ability to be able to do that, I think is vitally important. For some men, and this more is related to men, ethnic men, I think, and let me retract that, because it's not always. I think men in general could come in and they can be having difficulty with the system. And so I think it's important for us to think systemically. What sort of larger agency, or what larger organization, or what larger entity is having a negative impact on this man? And so it might require us to be able to help this man negotiate his life with this organizational entity that's out there. And so we know at some level that some of those organizational entities actually can grind any of us up and spit us out like we didn't never existed. And so I think that at some level, for some men, we need to be prepared to think systemically and to be able to support them systemically as well. And I think the last thing from a recommendation or key consideration standpoint is again for us to be able to be professionally and culturally empathic. And again, I think ultimately what that allows us to be able to do is it allows us to be able to hunt for this man's human dilemma. And then once we know what his human dilemma is, then we can convey it back to him that we accurately understood it, or that we can convey it back to him that we've understood it and that we can present it in an accurate manner. And I think that that's the key for demonstrating competence. I mean, I really believe that that's the number one demonstrative act of competence that we can show for our male clients, that we get it, that, you know, whatever it is, we get the essence of what they're presenting to us, and then we can begin to work and support them from that point.
Great. Great. Well, thank you so much. I've so enjoyed our time together, and thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Smith, for joining us today at CounselorAudioSource.net.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
You've just heard Dr. Jeffrey Smith from Creighton University speak about issues when counseling men with our contributing editor, Dr. Teresa O'Halloran. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at CounselorAudioSource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.